Good morning, everyone. I will have the marshal call us to order again.
Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Elise Larson presiding.
You may be seated. For the audio record, today is February 21st, 2024. Today's argument is being live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording. The audio recording of today's hearing will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. A reminder to those in the audience that no other recordings are permitted without the express permission of appeals. With that, we have three cases remaining on our oral argument calendar this morning, one with this panel, which is the second case on the docket in the matter of the welfare of E.E. Child, case number A231388. Good morning, counsel. As I'm sure you both know, you will each have 15 minutes for argument this morning. Appellants, you will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before beginning your arguments today, if you could identify yourselves and your client, we would appreciate that for the audio record. And with that, if you are ready to begin.
Your Honor's counsel, my name is Tricia Lair, representing the state of Minnesota. Appellant is respectfully requesting this court to reverse the findings in order and remand these proceedings. The issue before the court today is whether the district court abused its discretion in denying appellant's motion for presumptive certification. The district court did abuse its discretion. Respondent failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence that public safety would be served by retaining this matter in juvenile court. As I know this court is aware, in a presumptive certification case, appellant's only burden is establishing that the offense either is a commitment to prison or involved a firearm, and that the child was 16 years or older at the time of the offense. There's no dispute that appellant has met those burdens. Therefore, the burden shifts to respondent to establish by clear and convincing evidence that public safety would be served by maintaining this case in juvenile court. The court must consider the six public safety factors under Minnesota Statute 260B-125 Subdivision 4. And in its analysis, it must place the most weight on factors 1, seriousness of the offense, and 3, history of delinquency. Going through the factors, the district court erred in finding that factor 1, seriousness of the offense, weighed in favor of extended jurisdiction juvenile. The district court erred in its findings because the facts are not supported by the evidence in the record.
What facts? The facts as the district court found them or the facts that were presented to the district court?
The facts as the district court found them.
Okay. So on this record, I mean, you started off by indicating that you're asking for us to remand the certification proceedings to district court. Are you asking for the district court to reevaluate the seriousness of the offense, or are you saying that as a matter of law, given this record, that the seriousness of the offense must weigh in favor of certification?
As a matter of law, it must weigh in favor of certification.
And why is that? I mean, it's not a person offense that we're dealing with. What's the authority that this type of offense would give rise as a matter of law to a finding that the seriousness of the offense favors certification?
Because the court weighed its entire analysis on the programming and punishment available in juvenile court and the dispositional options available in juvenile court.
So that's what the district court found, but I'm asking you a different question. You're indicating that as a matter of law, based on this record that's presented to the district court, there's no option for the district court to make a finding that this factor does not weigh in favor of certification. Or are you not saying that?
Legally, the court has to consider the factor. There's no law that says the court has to consider the factor. There's not a lot of law out there that gives us guidance as to whether or not an offense is serious. The court erred because it rested its entire analysis on two factors that are already accounted for. So we have six factors for a reason. And when the court is using the factors multiple times in its analysis, there's no point in having six factors.
So let's extract those from the district court's permissible analysis under factor one. Are you saying that the district court has no discretion to make a determination as to the seriousness of the offense?
The district court does have discretion.
Okay, so when we remanded, if that's what you want, if that's what we end up doing, the district court gets to decide this issue, discounting how the factors that you've identified are accounted for in the other five factors under the certification analysis.
I apologize, Your Honor. Maybe that was error. I'm simply asking that you reverse her decision.
So you don't want a remand?
To allow her an opportunity to reevaluate? No.
On what basis would we be able to remand if that's per your request?
And that was an improper request of me, thinking that it would be remanded for proceedings in adult court. But if I'm interpreting that wrongly, and then I'm simply just asking this court to reverse the district court's finding.
Right. I understood the question to be reversed back to the district court to reconsider the factors. Because it sounds like what I'm hearing from you is that you disagree with the district court's analysis of the six factors, that it abused its discretion, which would seem to indicate that we would, if we were to grant you the relief you request, that we would not only reverse, but remand back to the district court to determine whether adult certification is necessary or whether or not respondent has proved by clear and convincing evidence that EJJ, continued EJJ, is the proper remedy. In other words, do its analysis again.
And I apologize if that is what this court believes the appropriate procedure is, then yes. If this court can simply reverse and overturn her decision and make the finding that this weighs in favor of certification, that is what I would be requesting.
Then what makes this offense clear? Going back to Judge Frisch's question, so if you want us to reverse the district court, then you need to make an argument that she's wrong, that this is a less serious offense, because the district court clearly said the offense that he is currently charged with is one that is the least serious because it did not involve an attack on a person. So what case law do you have that would support us reversing the district court that this was a less serious offense, where it is clear that this is not an offense on a person, and most of our cases that have weighed the seriousness factor are crimes where there is a victim involved?
Because the legislature has decided that this offense is so serious that it requires a 60-month commit to prison.
That true of all presumptives? Why is this even a factor? If every case that is a presumptive commit is also serious, then this isn't a factor. So what makes this different than just the fact that it's a presumptive commit?
Because it also involved a firearm. And because in order to
But isn't that what makes it a presumptive commit?
Yes.
Right? I think that the trouble that I'm having is with the conflation of a presumptive commit and, by definition, that being serious. Because then seriousness isn't a factor. It's just the very fact that it's a presumptive commit makes it serious. And I don't think that in a balancing test that makes a lot of sense, because that does, as just Frisch was pointing out, essentially remove any discretion that the district court would have in terms of actually analyzing whether this offense was serious.
And I understand what the court's saying. I don't think the district court did an appropriate analysis. It used other factors to find that
it's not
serious.
But that would be asking for a remand for the district court to reevaluate the seriousness, applying the law correctly. That's not asking for a flat-up reversal where we are saying this was a serious offense and we are reweighing that factor in a different manner than the district court.
I understand.
Okay.
I'd like to know what the authority is for us to remove from the district court's discretion the choice as to whether certification is appropriate, which is, I think, now what you're asking us to do. Like, we're going to divest the district court of their discretion, and we're going to make this determination. I don't know that we're well-suited to do that, and I just want to know what your best case is that would support that proposition.
Well, the standard is abuse of discretion, and appellant's position is there was an abuse of discretion. The facts that she used to support the findings in the factors are erroneous. They don't fit.
Unfortunately, district courts do get things wrong. I was a district court judge. I got things wrong from time to time, unfortunately. And then in a discretionary situation, it would get remanded back to me to make another decision. My question to you is that piece. What's your best authority that this doesn't go back to the district court for a do-over, that now we have to decide it? Because I'm not aware of any.
I don't have any authority for that.
Okay.
I understand the court's position in regards to seriousness of the offense. Appellant believes it is serious. Regardless of whether or not this court also believes that in and of itself it is a serious offense, I still believe that the district court erred in enough of the other factors that her total analysis in determining that this matter weighs in favor of extended jurisdiction juvenile is error. And I'm asking the court to remand it for her to make the correct findings.
Can I ask a question? There's another, another one of the factors. There's quite a bit of litigation that I've seen both at the in the transcript here and in other cases where there's discussion about the underdeveloped brains of juveniles and how that has contributed to culpability in some of these offenses. What, if any, role does that evidence play in a certification motion?
I think those things can be considered when they're evaluated by a psychologist. You have a psychologist usually and a corrections officer who do analysis of the juveniles and prepare reports for the court to consider. If someone's brain is so underdeveloped, then certainly you could bring a competency motion. That wasn't the case here.
No, my question is what among the public safety factors, does that play any role in the determination that the district court, or is that a fact that the district court can consider in its public safety analysis in determining certification?
I don't think that the law allows it. The case in welfare of HB specifically said that when you're determining culpability, the only thing that the court should consider is whether there are mitigating factors recognized by the sentencing guidelines that affect culpability at the time of the offense.
So one of the mitigating factors is age. So wouldn't underdeveloped brains associated with juveniles be a factor that's associated with age, which is a mitigating factor?
Yes, except the law specifically says that if you're 16 years or older and you commit a certain offense, it is a presumptive certification matter.
But that's at a threshold. That doesn't get to the substance of whether or not the juvenile's age can affect the culpability in the sense in terms of brain development, though. I mean, that's something that has been well documented. And in particular, one of my concerns in this case is you have a juvenile who repeatedly reoffended and didn't follow the rules until he got a little bit older. And I think you even acknowledged, at the end, he was starting to participate a little bit better in treatment. He had some successes. Isn't that related to the development of a youth's brain, in particular a male youth's brain?
I think, unfortunately, when you get to where we are today with this youth, he's 16, and he committed an offense that is a presumptive prison commit. It's a presumptive certification case. The standard isn't what's best for this juvenile at this point. The standard is what's best for public safety. There's all of the case law indicates, specifically if you're looking at their ability to be rehabilitated, the state does not have to prove that they're unamenable to treatment. The respondent has to prove that he's particularly amenable to treatment. That's what the case law says specifically in re-welfare of LM. It's not appellant's burden at this point. And respondent presented no evidence to establish he is amenable to probation. Quite the contrary. He went to every single intensive programming that the state of Minnesota has to afford him. He even told the psychological evaluator that the most intensive programming, Red Wing, did nothing for him, and he proved it when he got out and 1 month later was in a car with three loaded firearms and extended magazines.
So I, going back to Judge Frisch's question, does, I guess I have two questions. So the first is, I mean, part of the challenge for me is that responses to a lot of the questions are, because this is a presumptive prison commit, this factor should be weighed in a particular way, when these factors are supposed to have some ability for the district court to exercise discretion and evaluate them. And so saying age doesn't count because he's 16 takes the fact that age is one of those factors that can generally be evaluated as part of the district court's discretion. And so I don't know if you have any cases that have or could point us to any authority that has wrestled with this idea that it's a presumptive prison commit and therefore some of these factors must be weighed in a particular way because it's a presumptive prison commit?
I don't believe there's case law that has done that.
Okay.
I do know that when you're looking at specifically, I understand where the court's going. I understand your concerns. I'm hearing you that seriousness of the offense, you're right. It is already a presumptive commit to prison, and there will be certain times where things maybe won't be as serious. In this case, I think it is because he had a firearm and he has a lengthy history of crimes of very violent offenses.
Well, the lengthy history is factor three.
Right.
So, right. I mean, so if we're trying to keep these clear, which is what your criticism of the district court is conflating the factors. If we're trying to keep these separate, I think that we have to look at his history of delinquency and the seriousness of the offense separately. My other question to you is, what role can his age and sort of the known documented evidence regarding youth brains, how can that be calculated in terms of the adequacy of punishment and programming available in the system? Because when I look at the district court's order here, I think the district court was very focused on the fact that with regard to public safety, there were some reasons why keeping this in the EJJ system might actually would protect the public more because he would stay in the system until he was 21. And given the length of the sentence that he would get in an adult prosecution, he may actually be incarcerated longer and have access to better programming, which because of his age may ultimately benefit the public in the long run. And so do you think it was appropriate for the district court in evaluating factors 5 and 6 to be thinking about the fact that this is a 16-year-old in terms of thinking about that programming?
I don't, for the reasons that he's already had the programming and it didn't work. I do think if you have someone who's 16 years old and maybe has a history but didn't get the programming, maybe there's an argument there that age does play a factor because they haven't had a chance to have the programming. This juvenile has had all of the programming available to him, yet has continued to reoffend.
But how do you respond to the length of time and the differences in, I mean, the differences in the length of time in terms of he'll probably get out, if he's convicted as an adult, he'll probably get out at age 19, and while he's incarcerated, will not get any programming versus if he stays in EJJ, he very well could remain committed until the age of 21 and continue to get this intensive programming. Like, how has the district court abused its discretion in evaluating that distinction in this case, which makes it really different than other adult certification cases where the adult, the time that the individual would serve as an adult would be much lengthier than what you would get out of EJJ?
Because there's no evidence in the record as to the programming that the juvenile would get in the adult system. The court took it upon itself to assume that the juvenile would not get education in adult prison and assume that the juvenile would not get treatment in prison. There's no evidence in any of the exhibits that were entered by appellant establishing what that programming would look like and that there was zero programming for him. The district court assumed that the only way that he would get programming would be if it was retained in the juvenile justice system, and that's just not true.
Does anyone else have any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent. And feel free to adjust the, take time to adjust the podium, if that would help you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Drake Metzger. I represent the juvenile EE in this certification appeal. The district court order denying presumptive certification should be affirmed because I do not believe it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to find that public safety was best served by EJJ in this situation. And I'm just going to jump right in. The district court has the discretion to weigh the six factors in the context they're presented. And I think that is how we need to look at this case, the context of this case in EE's overall situation.
Well, is that really what the factors under the statute require and what HB requires in particular? I mean, when we look at the seriousness of the offense, I don't see any analysis really where the district court broke down what actually happened here. That we have a person with three loaded firearms hidden in a car. He's wearing a ski mask. I mean, there's a lot there about this offense that the district court said not word one about. And so it looks to me like maybe the seriousness of this offense to this community is what the district court is supposed to be looking at, and that didn't happen here.
At least
that's my read of the order.
I would agree that there's not a discussion of the specific facts in that section. I think the complaint was obviously cited verbatim by the district court in its order. The statement of probable cause was in the court's order. So obviously the district court had those facts and considered those. But again, in the context of the situation here, you have a prohibited person charge. It's not a person crime. You have a felony fleeing, not a person crime. Felony fleeing is a severity level one offense.
But a felony fleeing, there are degrees of what a felony fleeing involves. I mean, if you're speeding down a residential street at 60 miles an hour, that's extremely dangerous. That is a serious public safety concern, as opposed to felony fleeing, I'm driving 10 miles an hour down a residential street. That's a different threat to the community, right? You'd agree with that, right?
Yeah.
Don't those kinds of distinctions require the district court to look at this offense, what happened here, and then evaluate the public safety concern to the community?
Well, I don't think the statute requires that by the definition or by the wording of the statute.
Does HB require that? I mean, the Supreme Court was pretty stark in its analysis.
I concede that. But that said, Your Honor, even the facts of this case aren't the typical egregious case where we're driving, 100 miles an hour through traffic.
Well, the only reason he didn't is because the police officers were concerned of his threat to safety and put the spikes underneath the car to prevent him from taking off. He took off anyway, ran over the spikes, and still drove down the road with flat tires. And when he took off, he nearly hit one of the officers. So the officers may have prevented more harm to somebody. He almost harmed somebody and potentially could have harmed other people. I mean, the seriousness of the alleged offense is pretty significant here, isn't it?
I disagree. I don't agree that
Well,
it is.
The district court did, I mean, the district court's analysis of that issue is light, but the district court did say that did favor certification. And just to step back, ultimately it's the juvenile's responsibility to prove by clear and convincing evidence, correct? So he's presumed to be committed unless he can prove by clear and convincing evidence based on these six factors, of which the most important are, one, the seriousness of the alleged offense, including the use of a firearm, and there were firearms, not one, not two, but three there, and then the child's prior record of delinquency. I think it's pretty clear he's got a fairly extensive record of delinquency in different parts of the state. So those two have to be weighed more heavily, correct?
Factors one and three, are weighed more heavily, yes.
Those seem to be, and given that, And given the fact that the second element of the culpability of the child, the district court actually said that one favored EJJ, I'm not sure speaking for myself, I agree with that. And I think you conceded that the district court erred on that one as well, correct?
In terms of their analysis of the culpability?
Right.
Yes. Yeah, I would concede that the district court's analysis of that factor was not correct. But I still think that the culpability factor weighs in favor of EJJ. I would also just circling back to factor one.
Why is that? I mean, because he was the driver, and in the prior situations, he was actually the passenger, but he was the driver in this case, right?
Sure.
He was the driver. He's wearing a ski mask, three guns in the car, flees the officer, gives the officers false information. It sounds like the culpability in this particular situation is fairly high. Wouldn't you agree?
It's a constructive possession case as it relates to the firearm. He's in a car I don't believe he's a registered owner of. To my knowledge, there's no DNA evidence linking him to the gun. The gun is found under the seat. I think there are mitigating factors as it relates to that offense, which is the more severe, I would say, of the two. And circling back to the seriousness
factor. It's the planning and carrying out of the offense. The offense was fleeing the officers. He was the driver. He's the one who fleed.
On that count, I would agree. Yeah, he is more culpable for sure. Okay. I'm not trying to say that. But as it relates to the more severe of the two offenses, the one that carries the presumptive 60-month commit, I think there's more mitigating factors as it relates to, you know, if this were to go to trial, how that would play out.
So you have three factors that appear to support the presumptive commit.
I don't agree that factor one supports the presumptive commit.
The seriousness of the offense?
Yeah, and again, I think the context of the situation is what the focus needs to be on here.
So you disagree with the district court's decision on that factor?
On the seriousness of the offense? Yes. My recollection was that the court found that did not favor certification.
I thought the district court, I could be wrong, but I thought the district court thought it did favor.
I believe the district court thought that that factor favored EJJ. But either way, I think, again, in the context...
You're right. You're correct, counsel.
In the context of the situation, you know, I think you have a 60-month presumptive commit. And that, I mean...
just continue with the seriousness. I mean, we do have cases from our court where we've sort of noted that when evaluating the seriousness factor, that, you know, most of the cases where... we have said, yes, this is a, you know, reversible decision in terms of seriousness, have been when it's a violent crime against another person. And I haven't in my research been able to find a case where we have said the district court abused its discretion when it found a crime weighed in favor of certification, where we flip the district court saying, the seriousness of the crime weighs in favor of certification where there wasn't a victim involved. Can you think of a case that, or did you find any cases in your research that did?
I can't recall one that where the district court was flipped, no. But I do think, again, the fact that it's not a person crime, even though it is a presumptive commit, again, in the context of the EJJ situation, I think the court, what they did was think about public safety as a whole, not just short-term but long-term. And overall, on EJJ, EE would be in custody potentially until 21, still with potential for prison time hanging over his head up until that point. Whereas if he just is certified as an adult, let's say he's convicted of this crime right out of the gate, he's back out on the streets at 19 after 40 months, as the court correctly noted. What's changed, I think the court asks. And I think that's how the analysis as it relates to the seriousness of the offense needs to be analyzed in terms of what the actual prison sentence looks like, in terms of how serious this is. And then
you disagree with appellant that it was that the district court abused its discretion when it analyzed the length of the sentence in terms of evaluating the seriousness of the offense.
Well, I think the length of the presumptive sentence is something to be considered in determining how serious an offense is. And I think in the context of prior cases, you know...
And so the fact that this is a shorter presumptive commit than first-degree assault or something like that would be something that a district court could weigh in terms of evaluating the seriousness of the offense in your argument.
I would agree. And you know, in terms of whether or not this is a certification, all of them require prison sentence, a potential presumptive prison sentence. So I think you correctly noted that, you know, like in terms of the seriousness, they're all prison sentences. But I think the fact that this is not a person crime with only 60 months, which will be almost as long as he'll be on EJJ, is something to be considered in terms of how serious this offense was. And so that's what I think the court did.
Aren't you conflating two factors by doing that analysis? Shouldn't we be looking at the seriousness of the offense itself and whether or not there are any mitigating factors, including whether there was a use of a firearm or a firearm was present? It sounds like you're taking the options of, the two options and incorporating that, conflating that with the seriousness of the offense factor.
No, I'm just merely comparing the prison sentence of the offense in concluding that it's not a serious offense because it's only a 60-month potential commit. I'm not conflating. I don't believe that that's conflating those two issues.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you some questions about the programming history here because, as you know, your client has not done well in programming over many, many opportunities. And when I read the district court's order, it appears that the district court is focused on a hope that in the future that programming opportunities might be of benefit to your client without discussing any of the past, I'll use the word transgressions that your client has engaged in with those programming opportunities. Why isn't that an abuse of discretion by the district court in light of J.H.? And other Supreme Court precedent?
Well, I agree that I think the court is clearly hopeful that new programming would help.
I think all district court judges are hopeful that programming will help, quite frankly.
Sure.
Yes.
But I do think that that hope is not just a baseless hope. I think that's supported by the fact that he is showing progress. And I think even the, I believe it was Mr. McGrath's, it was the probation officer's report, indicating that in his most recent incarceration.
Red ring, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was doing very well, and he showed that he can take programming. It takes him a while to kind of break some barriers down and then take to the programming, but he does do that. And then in his most recent incarceration on this offense, I think it was the...
I understand the record. My question is, when the district court only evaluates the very isolated positive experience that your client had in a very short period of time and doesn't even mention a long history of not good behavior on programming, is that an abuse of discretion by the district court given this record?
Well, I don't think the court did that. In its order, it does go through the history in the factual findings and does go through. It says, you know, he's out this long before he reoffends. He comes out of custody this date. He reoffends within this many days. You know, the court does break down that timeline and discuss that in its factual findings.
But it doesn't evaluate it in its conclusion of law or the evaluation of this factor. You agree, though?
I agree that those are not specifically cited in its analysis. But again, I do think the public safety being the touchstone of the analysis here, the court is thinking long-term, and given that it's only a 60-month commit, where he'd be back on the streets at 19.
It's also not clear to me from the record, quite frankly, that the programming at Red Wing resulted in positive reports. It looked to me like he was doing well in school, which I appreciate very much, but that is, under JH, not a factor that can be considered in terms of evaluating public safety. Was there a specific program that I just missed in the record that he excelled at, or school?
I don't recall, other than the school, the specific programming. I know he did participate in other programming. I think that was in the juvenile or the
report.
Probation report.
Okay.
But no, I can't recall one that he excelled at specifically off the top of my head.
Okay.
But again, overall, I think in the context of the situation, you know, and overlapping all of this is 129 months he's still got hanging over his head in Hennepin. And I think given that, the court is looking at this in that context that he's presented to her, thinking, why not take one more chance? Why not do this? You know, public safety would be better served.
I mean, I understand why the district court did that, but I'm wondering if the district court even has discretion to consider what other pending offenses are out there, whether a potential consequence in Hennepin is something that she could consider in determining whether to certify this particular case. I'm not aware of authority that allows a district court judge to do that.
I think she's required to consider his prior delinquency history and record, and that would include anything he's on probation for and has hanging over his head. So I think that's built into factor three.
So but would say that future consequences are built into factor three, potential future consequences?
In terms of the fact that he might have to do I just want to make sure I clarify your question. So in terms of a potential probation violation, I see my time. Sorry.
Yeah.
In terms of potential probation violation resulting in commit?
That he's got 129 over his head, and if he violates probation in Hennepin, that's the consequence he's facing over there, or that's a more serious offense than this one. I mean, it does seem like the district court is looking at other problems that he could potentially face punishment for in determining whether to certify this case. And I'm just wondering what authority the district court has to do that.
Well, again, I think the factor three, you have to consider his record of delinquency and, you know, what he does have hanging over his head, if that's the case.
So you just say that record includes potential future consequences.
I think you have to consider, at least you have to acknowledge that in terms of considering his delinquency history.
Okay, thank you.
Other than that, I see my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Yeah.
Thank you again, Your Honors. Just briefly, I wanted to touch on a few things that I could see that the court was interested in, and one is in regards to seriousness of the offense. I do think the court was correct in where it was going in regards to victim offenses, person crimes. And this case did involve victims, not only the two officers that he almost struck when he took off, but the five other individuals that were in his car when he crashed it. One of them actually jumped out of the car. You know, those individuals were put in a serious situation where they could have been killed. He took off and hit those stop strips and crashed into a bridge. So although the gun wasn't used against someone, the fleeing did involve him putting other people in a public safety risk situation. So I do think the court should consider that.
But the crimes themselves are not based on there being victims present. I think that's right. That's the point that respondent is trying to make, is you need to look at the charge, the crime that's actually been charged, and the crime that's actually been charged doesn't require the presence of a victim.
It does not require it, but it did exist in this situation, and I think that's something the court should consider. In regards to culpability, just wanted to point out again that the court did not find any of those mitigating factors. So there are no mitigating factors there. If there were, she did not put any of them in her order. The last thing I wanted to touch on is the punishment and programming available. I just wanted to highlight again, respondent said that it looked as it was supported by the fact that he was showing progress in Red Wing, and this court pointed out that really the only progress he was making was in his education. And I, as well as the court, appreciate that and want to see that for this young man as well. However, what the law says is it's not just what they do when they're in the programming, it's how they transfer those skills when they get into the community. Specifically, that PCT says, I think it's PCT, I apologize, that the court needs to consider not only what they did while they're in the facility, but then how they use what they've learned in the community to really determine whether or not the programming was there, and then the other portion of factor four, which is their willingness to participate. And the court has found multiple times that they have to show that they have taken that that programming and then show the positive behavioral changes in the community, and there's just not a record that he did that there. Additionally, PCT said that, this court said that failure at rehabilitation will create an extreme risk to public safety. The risk is too great to justify an attempt to modify the offender's behavior in the juvenile system. I think, unfortunately, that's where we found ourselves with this young man. For those reasons, and because of the fact that this is a presumptive certification case, I am respectfully requesting that you remand this matter.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments this morning. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute.